Austin Chadwick. This is Chris Lucian, and today we have a good opportunity to talk to Alex Benardzik.
Nice.
Yeah, all right. And we're really excited to have you on the show and get us going. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, Alex?
First of all, thanks for inviting me. Quite excited to be on your show. I was following some of your episodes, and it's really interesting what you guys are doing. It kind of really coincides with what I'm doing in my daily practice. I work as a consultant, and I consult with large government organizations. What's really interesting nowadays is everybody's moving into DevOps, Agile DevOps, and there is a lot of cultural transformational things going on, and they do need some, you know, guiding hand from people who have been around the block a few times. And so I spend my work days as a software engineering practice lead. I'm leading teams, and there are fairly numerous teams. Like currently there's 8 teams I'm leading, and they're doing different things, but we're trying to normalize and get everybody on the same page. Agile DevOps is a fantastic discipline, but it's one of those things that, like chess game, you can explain the rules in 5 minutes, but it takes a lifetime to master.
Like the analogy, yeah.
And so sometimes people do not necessarily get that communicated, so they're hoping to get something quick and dirty up and running and with brilliant results in no time, which is not the case. So patience is virtue, and we work with business and we try to explain that the real value is not necessarily in just quick and dirty delivery, but also in lowering the cost of change. And the cost of change is what's killing us. Yeah. And so if we just quickly cobble something up and like, yeah, we're doing awesome, and we push it out, that's fantastic. We learn something from it, and this is really what we want to do. But if we learn the lesson and we cannot do anything about it because we painted ourselves in the corner, then that's counterproductive. And yeah. So what we're trying to teach here is how do you increase speed, but not compromise your ability to minimize risk and to continue delivering quality. So it has to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. It's not like one-time shot. You're first to the market and you grab your territory and then what? You know. So that's what we are focusing on here. And I started teaching TDD about a year ago, and you know, it is a fairly involved subject matter. Little by little, we came to the point of saying, why don't we have a TDD dojo? Mm-hmm. And this will be a hands-on, you know, dedicated time for focused exercises in TDD. And then naturally, the best way to do it is mob style.
All right.
Because my initial experimentations about a year ago, actually about 10 months ago, was half-baked mob, where I would be standing in front of the crowd of developers, and I would be coding, like real-time coding, and they will be shouting, no, do this, try that, blah, blah, blah. You know, and that kind of, you know, that was interesting, but I felt it's not really kicking, you know, the ball.
Yeah.
So switching over to the proper mob with, you know, the driver, the navigator, the facilitator, and all the, you know, the mob. And then I discovered that it really, the secret sauce, in my opinion, is a 4-minute rotation, the musical chairs.
All right.
The bomb collection. not spending time deliberating, like, okay, that's an interesting idea. However, this is a real blah, blah. No, you have an idea, try it out. Because it's TDD, anything you try, you can instantly test. You can run your test and see if you're in red or in green. If you're in green, move on to the next. If you're in red, okay, what now? So that chemistry that happens, that dynamic, was really proven to be very, very rich, in the sense that people sometimes, you know, my students leave the session saying, I can't wait for the next one. I can't wait to see what happens.
I like hearing that.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It is very, very, it is phenomenally engaging. One thing I discovered also that I don't know how to deal with. So long as we are staying within kind of familiar territory, and I give challenges, and we are doing challenges mob style, and it really is going well. with the expected, you know, forming, storming, norming, and performing. The curve always happens like that. We had situations where if people are not familiar with the technique, then mobbing seems to really ends up at a storming phase.
Yeah, yeah. So, you're introducing something new.
Yeah. You know, I wasn't sure, like, what is the best way, whether you need to have some kind of a preemptive formal training session and then move into, because I felt like if you're not familiar with something, then mobbing is maybe going to confuse you even more.
Mm.
Now, maybe I'm wrong on that. These are very early findings.
Thanks for sharing.
Definitely, I can vouch that if you're familiar with the, you know, the domain and the technique, then mobbing is the way to go, for sure, right? And now I'm trying to discover how do we reconcile introducing new, brand new things into the mob, and maybe there's some way, maybe you guys know, can share some.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have a follow-up question to maybe help us with our answer is, what can you describe in more detail the problems you're seeing? So it's something... Is it like something new that nobody in the mob, not one person knows how to do? And then what happens as a result of that leads to this storming that you don't like?
It's not that nobody in the mob knows, but it's a binary thing. Either a couple of guys know it really well, and the rest absolutely never tried it. And so the chemistry didn't seem to happen during the session. So that was one session when we left it really disappointed that we spent an hour and and it was really kind of, oh my God, I didn't expect that, right? So, you know, what was happening is we did, previous session was a phenomenal session where we had I introduced the challenge and they were going through that first phase of flailing and not going anywhere. And slowly you can see that everything is gelling and then everything clicks in. And then it's like pack of wolves going after the, you know, the prey, and they just nailed it. It was beautiful. So the solution was really high quality.
Yeah.
Following session, I introduced the concept. I don't know if you guys are familiar, the concept of mutation testing.
Yes.
So the previous solution was everything in green, all unit tests passed, the code is beautiful, everything is gorgeous. Then I'm going into the, okay, guys, let's go into the reflection phase before we refactor. Let's reflect. And the way to reflect, let's run mutation testing. And mutation testing ran, killed all the mutants. There was one surviving mutant, one lousy mutant. Okay, guys, let's kill this mutant and move on to the next challenge. We spent almost 1 hour. We couldn't kill the lousy mutant. Very shocking. Like, how is this possible? You know, we have a trust of talented guys here. And they were just going in circles, and nothing was happening, right? So then I realized that maybe they, you know, they need some more prior training to understand mutation testing, to understand how to deal with mutants. Because at the end of the day, in my opinion, if you have some surviving mutants in your branch, that does not qualify to be merged.
Sure.
You need to get rid of those. Because mutant implies some mysterious code. There's something mysterious going on in your repo, which you haven't really described, and nobody can explain what's going on there. If we say, okay, there's this, you know, block of code that is generating the mutant, we don't know why is it there. Can we purge it? No, because we don't know what's going to happen, right? So, you know, to me, it's not good engineering. If you have some mysterious part of your code where nobody knows why is it there, at the same time, nobody's okay with deleting it.
Did the mutant not ultimately become a unit test and solving it the original way, or was it just randomly appearing from time to time and people were getting frustrated and chasing it down?
No, the mutant is consistent.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's, in my experience, because I did a lot of mutation testing, there's possibly three reasons why there is a mutant. Like you said, most likely, unit test is missing, and therefore, you know, it's the mutation testing framework is saying, look, I have some code here, and nobody's expecting anything. If I change the logic, the unit tests are not complaining. Therefore, this is dangerous. Like if you have some processing logic and you change it, you flip it on its head, and your unit tests are okay with that, this is a dangerous situation in my mind, right? So another reason why we can have a mutant is if part of your code is not testable, actually. There is a situation where it's not testable. And you can write as many unit tests you want, but that untestable part remains, meaning you have to refactor it. And the third, and probably the rarest case, is if something's wonky with your expectation, with your spec, or with your user story, however you call it, your acceptance criteria. We find holes there as well, right? It hasn't been thought through. Therefore, we are implementing, following the, you know, if we're doing 3Cs and we do confirmation example, and maybe that part needs to be debugged, and the mutation framework is pointing at the actual upstream, at the source of your requirements, your expectation. And I've seen that as well. So it's fantastic. It can actually point at some of the glaring mistakes upstream from when we take the story and run with it.
You can go ahead, and then I have a thought when you're done.
Yeah, so basically, in this case, I subsequently realized that it could be fixed by going back and re-examining the starting premise of the challenge. And there's one, what I'm trying to say is that the expectations were too vague. They needed to be more crisp, more, you know, you need to decompose your expectations further.
Yeah.
And then when you do that, then you kill all the mutants. Tricky thing, right? And not surprisingly, we couldn't fix it as a mob who is not experienced in that type of development. But again, points back to the question, is mobbing, how effective is it in introducing brand new techniques and you know, paradigms and whatever you want to call it?
I think there's like three situations, right? There's, you have a mob and everybody knows kind of how to move forward. And so that mob is going to, like, it's going to gel really well. Things are going to move forward really fast. Then you have a mob and one person doesn't know, but everybody else knows. That one person can feel left behind. And then maybe you have the opposite situation, where it's, you have a mob and either one person or no people know.
Yeah.
And that's also another situation. I don't know, Austin, do you have?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, and there's a couple other situations too. I mean, some problems are really tough to crack, and, you know, mobbing it has a greater likelihood of finding it, but it doesn't guarantee a solution in an hour. I mean, there's been some, you know, we had a mob of three or four, and there's been problems that it was like, we're trying to figure out somehow some API works to do what we wanted to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the documentation's not great, or maybe there's something unclear about it. And we were mobbing it, and it took a while to figure it out, you know what I mean? And sometimes we were kind of doing traditional mobbing where, you know, driver, navigator, and everyone's focused on the mob station, and sometimes there was like a pair experimenting on a laptop while another pair was at the mob station running experiments. And so I've still found mobbing to be extremely valuable in that situation, because you basically can run, it's almost like this, you have multiple things going on at the same time, but you're all working on the same problem, right?
Yep.
And so I might, there's been situations where over here, the other, the pair in the same mob, like say something like, oh yeah, this, and then we try it and then we solve it with that. And so I still find value in it, but I think frustrating problems are going to be frustrating problems, whether it's one person or a mob, I suppose.
Yeah.
Right?
And
so, yeah.
So just to clarify, there's never,
yeah.
in my mind, a wasted minute in mobbing.
Right.
Even,
yeah.
you know, I was talking about the frustration of not solving it.
Yeah.
But the time wasn't wasted because I've observed in our mob, there's a pretty large discrepancy in the skill levels. We have some awesome, like, rock stars, you know, black belt. And we have some, you know, kind of novices, or don't know how to call them. And I've observed that in the mobbing situation, novices pick up so many new skills.
Yes.
And it is an environment where it's almost like emotional. So when you learn a new technique, it stays with you. You can see that the person who learned new technique at that moment feels so pleased. Now I have something new under my belt that I can I can kick ass at my job.
Yeah.
I think people appreciate that. Because if you're sitting in your desk or at your desk and you're watching some Pluralsight video or you're reading some blogs, and you may learn something, but maybe tomorrow it doesn't stay with you, right? It's like so many things that just go through your mind. But in the mobbing situation, because I'm a facilitator and I look, I can see some people, this tremendous sense of relief, like, oh my God, that's how we do it. Now I learned it, and it's going to stay with that, right?
Yep.
So it's like the tide lifts all the boats, right?
Yeah.
Everybody gets their level higher. So this is fantastic. All I'm saying was not everything gets...
it's not solved every time.
I was expecting, right? And you're right, maybe some of these problems require multiple sessions and require some further reflection and some further Googling offside of the, So, but overall, I'm big... fan and big proponent of mobbing,
yeah.
And I think this probably could be the future. But I also, I would like to experiment with like the whole team.
Yeah.
Because right now we're just teaching TDD, and these are people who will be doing TDD. I'd like to bring security engineers, cloud engineers.
Nice.
I'd like to bring business engineers. I would like to bring product owners, because the value here is in immediate sharing of information.
Mm-hmm.
This is the big value, like right there. You are stuck with something and you know that this guy knows it, but he may be in a meeting and maybe I'll ask him tomorrow, and it all kind of fizzles, right?
Yeah.
But if we're mobbing, it's there. You resolve everything right there.
You get the flow efficiency, right?
So that's tremendous value. Yeah. What we still don't know exactly is the optimal size of the mob,
mm-hmm.
and the optimal timing. Like we are learning, like in my mind, 4-minute rotation works fantastic and nobody ever came to me complaining about why is it only, people are curious, like, well, where did you come up with four minutes? So, I think it's almost like an industry expectation. Some people are going for 15. I feel 15 minutes kind of intrudes a little bit of lethargy.
Yeah.
4 minutes is keeping everybody on their toes. Everybody's like, okay, rotation and it keeps the juices flowing.
Yeah.
We haven't had a chance to experiment with like a longer session with like half day or full day mobbing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the dojo is kind of limited. So I don't know what effect that will, maybe you guys know more about if you have a whole day mob, right? It must be overwhelming, right?
Yeah. Also, I think that, the mobs in our organization, they go for 7 hours a day, and then an hour of learning session, learning, personal learning time or group learning time. And so I think rather than trying, my recommendation is rather than trying to find the ideal amount of time to mob or to switch or on the rotation, is to regularly have a retrospective about the rotation time. And so it can go up or down, or some people may be feeling better with, 5 minutes one day and 3 minutes another day. And then the same thing for retrospective frequency, all that stuff. Basically, if you come into it saying that this is a flexible thing, different teams will land at what's good for them. Because I honestly believe the right size of the mob and the right amount of time on the timer is different for different people and their different interpersonal interactions. So I would suggest, rather than saying, okay, it's 4 minutes, just say, we normally start with 4 minutes. Let's try 4 minutes now, and then tomorrow we'll try a different time, and we'll write down how we feel, and then the next day we'll try, and then chart it over time, and then kind of figure out for our group what's the best way, what's the best time. And then I have a comment on the getting stuck. One thing a pattern that I've seen that's been really helpful for mobs that get stuck is, there's one is asking for help, which is just like going to another mob and bringing somebody in. Another one is, there's a mob programming role-playing game, there's a archivist role, that I really like. And that's just this idea of like writing things up on the board. And so, if you've ever read the Checklist Manifesto or some of these like kind of like, empirical analysis, publications, the one thing that I think that people don't necessarily do, but think to do often enough, is this idea of writing down a checklist of things to evaluate and go through and say, because I think if people are saying, oh, there's a mutant that's causing a failure, and that mutant can't be removed, it's it's really important to just say, okay, what levels of the stack could we evaluate for that failure, and then systematically go through and check off this list. Okay, we've evaluated this piece and this piece and this piece, and as people get ideas, put them up on a whiteboard or on sticky notes, and then slowly check them off, because people tend to go around in circles if there's no history. I've seen this phenomenon on mobs that I've been on, where if there was no documentation of this sort up on a wall, then the team would actually spend so long evaluating the problem that they'll start trying the things that they tried at the beginning again, and they'll just go in a loop. And the way that you break that loop is by writing explicitly everything that's there.
Yeah.
Okay. Remember we talked at the beginning about I have another topic to discuss?
Yeah.
Which is right now we are doing, we are mobbing in the TDD dojo. And as I explained, all the participants are familiar with TDD. You know, they know how to do it, and now we're just exercising. And we have yesterday, one student passed the yellow belt kata. We have katas and graduation programs for people to graduate and go up and become ninjas and whatnot.
That's
and so that's great. But we are now about to introduce another dojo with another relying on the same experience with the mobbing, which would be what I mentioned to you, approximation before precision.
Yes.
So what it is basically is, and now the reason I want to talk about this is I think we're breaking new territory here, right? And people are out of necessity going to be mystified and confused, and what do we mean by that? But basically, you know, it all stems from the, if you study the reason why we abandoned waterfall and kind of flirting with agile and going back into agile, one of the main reasons in waterfall is that waterfall projects are notorious for starting immediately with precision work.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, you get your developers and everybody starts doing precisely, you know, to the expectations. And then because it's gated phases, late in the project, we start looking, can we integrate? And then we realize, these things don't, you know, cannot talk to each other. And that is very expensive failure.
Mm-hmm.
So with Agile, we want to fail as soon as possible to expose any significant risks. And what that means is we want to first do the approximation work, like bullet tracing, and whatever our solution consists of, we need to first, in very vague, broad strokes, establish that, yes, everything's there, everything. Things like if you buy IKEA furniture, you open the box, and first thing you do, you lay out the all the pieces, you count them, right?
Yeah.
You count them, because something's missing, you drive back to IKEA and get...
That's what I've been doing wrong.
Back. But you don't want to start screwing things and really tightening up and realize, I'm missing one piece or something's not there. So approximation, to establish approximation is super important, because it guarantees that you're not going to fail expensively in the project and then, you know, have all the ashes and whatnot, you know, mea culpa, whatnot. And so to do that, what I'm introducing to establish approximation is what's known as service virtualization. And we are using a product called Mountebank. I don't know if you guys heard of that.
Mm-hmm. No.
Mountebank is a fantastic tool that allows you to impersonate service, HTTP, HTTPS, SMTP, TCP, and it's really powerful platform, which enables us to do real agile type of work where you can control your dependencies and you can actually build, you can pretend the whole universe is there by just having everything in the local host running, and you can pretend, you know, all kinds of scenarios, all kinds of pathological behaviors, difficult to reproduce scenarios, edge cases, whatnot. And this is your approximation. And now, anytime you make a change in your repo, you run all these integration tests and confirm that, yes, still everything's working, right? So this service virtualization is super important to our organization, and we are intending to move with the dojo and with mobbing. But again, I'm trying to establish what's the best way not to have those I don't want to say futile, but those mobbing sessions where we don't actually solve the problem and people get disheartened, right? Because we like small victories. People, I like when people say, I can't wait for the next session, rather than saying, oh my God, we didn't go anywhere. Yeah, and I'm very careful. I don't want to create that negative, we did not manage to move the needle in this session.
Yeah.
And I'm at this point examining what's the best way to introduce brand new paradigm. Because even talking to people, I see that, people tend to get mystified with, for example, if you buy a fire detector, you don't, if you want to test it, you don't set your house on fire, right?
Yeah.
So
that's the true test.
The end-to-end test.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so to test, to ensure that everything will be working, you don't need to actually touch the real thing.
Yeah.
So long as you understand how it behaves, you can simulate it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I find that people are not necessarily trusting that, right? No. Unless I really touch the real thing, I don't know if. So, for example, if you are a car battery manufacturer and you manufacture the car to the battery to the specification, you don't test it by going to every car and putting it in and see if it works.
Yeah.
You test it by simulating the alternator and seeing what the output is. If it's 14 volts, whatever it is, right? And once you know, you see that, you know that this battery is going to work. You don't have to go and put it in the actual car, right?
Yeah.
So same is here. You know, we understand the expectation, we understand the contract. All we have to do is just simulate it, and our code will be conforming to that simulation, and then we are good to go. So that is the hurdle we are trying to go over and organize the dojo and organize the mobbing to go into that. So that's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out, because it's new, brand new territory. It's not familiar.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how this will play out, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of going back to the getting stuck, and then if you're going to do mobbing dojo sessions on something that's new and novel or that not many people have experience on, two things come to mind. And one is basically set the stage and set people's expectations. Because I've done mobbing dojos before where I didn't make it clear that we're going to solve a problem that's insolvable in the time box we have. Like,
yes.
And then people enjoyed it, but then they were telling me after, like, well, I really wanted to finish it. And I was just like, oh, well, I should just set the stage at the beginning.
Yeah,
like,
it's impossible.
The goal is not to solve it, you know. And so to say, like, hey, we're going to be doing a spike or a research task as a mob. We're not going to, you know, we may surprise ourselves and get there and quickly, but we may not. And so you change the benchmark to be more of a research or a spike. And then, like what Chris said, you retrospect more often the more experimentation it is, because it's going to feel more, there's going to be more emotions, there's going to be more, it's going to feel slower. And so to say, like, hey, okay, we've experimented for an hour, what did we learn? And then to, like, write those things down and then, like, all right, what's our next card, you know, from the things we've learned? And, like, the facilitation and retrospectives needs to go up higher, I think, in those scenarios. So
I agree. I do have high expectations, because just to go back to my TDD example.
Right, yeah.
I do a lot of teaching and, you know, presentations and showing people, but nothing compares to the mobbing when they go and actually do the rotation and start doing it. All of a sudden, the skill, the technique, you know, everything just picks up.
Yep.
And so passive presentations and whatnot, I don't think it's the best way to do it. Right?
Yeah,
I mean, maybe necessary at first, but it doesn't really take you far.
Yeah.
Unless you really roll up your sleeves and you start touching the thing and you start picking up the pointers and the tips and whatnot, you're not going to go far, right?
Yeah.
And that's why I'm enthused about the mobbing, because I can see not only is it good for, like, learning new skills, also phenomenal for... how should I put it? We all become buddies there. We get to know each other.
Yeah,
definitely.
Right? It breaks those barriers or those mini silos that if you have eight, you can imagine if you have eight teams, everybody's in their own corner.
Yeah.
You know, working like hell. They don't have time to maybe you know, socialize, but as colleagues, as you know, people who work in the same organization.
Yeah.
It's very good to be in the same room and see each other work and learn about,
yeah,
I didn't know you're good at that, right? And you learn from your, and then we leave it's almost like a party. Like it's almost we're having a party. We live in a good. People are laughing. People are having poking fun, jokes, blah blah blah, and it creates this really culture. It creates a brand new culture, I think.
Yeah.
That cements the team, and you feel like, I like coming to work in the morning. I'm having fun here.
Nice.
We are breaking barriers. We are making things happen. So from that angle, it's fantastic. But, I also want to see how far we get with introducing brand new concepts.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I'll share one more thing and then maybe one last question. Then we're starting to hit the end of our time box. But this has been a fantastic discussion. One thing occurred to me is it's been about every week on Fridays we've been doing group learning together. So people who don't normally mob together come together and mob. And we pick a topic. And often it's something we've never done before. And so just to say, it can go well doing a new novel concept as a mob. I've also seen it not go well at times as well. And so it's good to learn from those. But just to say that it can be done and it's been a really enjoyable experience. I encourage you to give it a shot and inspect in depth, see how it goes. And then maybe the one last thing before we close out is I couldn't help but ask a little bit more about... how did you come to hear about mobbing and come to try it out? Because I was able to follow, I've been following you for a little bit, and I think I saw part of the journey of, hearing about mobbing and then deciding one day to try it out. And if you maybe give a little bit more about that before we close it, it'd be good for me.
Yeah, I've been a big fan of extreme programming for about 18 years.
Yeah.
And then going into Agile and going into TDD and all these other things. And every now and then you hear mob programming and, of course, pair programming was since the day one.
Yeah.
But it's always been somehow half-baked because unless you really try it at your job, right?
Yeah.
Then you see the real value, right? You can read about it, you can watch videos and blah, blah, blah. But something happens when you're in that room and you can, the energy is palpable.
Yeah.
And, I don't want to wax poetic and blah, 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 but I feel the chemistry. I feel how people, the blame, it's fantastic. It just takes a few minutes, few moments for any blame to just disappear. There's no blame in the room.
Yeah.
There's no stupid idea. People feel totally free to throw out any outlandish, whatever comes to mind, and we are all laughing and having fun and trying it. The bias to action, I think, is also secret sauce. Yeah.
Hmm.
Let's just do things. Let's not stop talking about concepts and that's fine. We can do it at the water cooler. But in that particular mobbing situation, just keep doing things, right?
Yep.
And that creates this momentum. It creates this energy that I can physically feel it, right? And everybody, it's almost like we are all elevated after the session. At least I can speak for myself that I feel great after the session. Right? So, it gradually came to me as part of this entire, XP, Agile, DevOps, et cetera, it is a fantastic area to plunge into. You can learn something new every day. There's no way you can tell, now I know what Agile is. We don't know. We just kind of keep discovering, right?
Yeah.
You're on the same journey. Same is with XP. I'm following, my mentors, Kent Beck, Ron Jeffries. These guys are just blows your mind how fantastic these guys are. Their ideas, their insights. Every day I follow them, I'm like, oh my God, how did you come up with that, right? I really enjoy that, right? I think this is something that makes the job worthwhile, right? It's not a job, it's like a life, right? You live it, you enjoy it, you meet people.
Yep.
Unfortunately, meet you guys.
Yeah,
you as well.
It is just this joy of doing something useful while challenging yourself and growing and not being stuck in some rut.
It definitely turns the traditional software development visual that people might get of this lone developer in a corner by themselves, probably lonely, to a very social, interactive, high energy environment.
Software development is a contact sport.
Yeah.
It is a social activity. It is all day long. I want everybody on the floor, the whole team, face-to-face, most important, all this agile thing, face-to-face, forget about what is the most important thing right now. This is the question we always keep asking. Okay, right now, what is the most important thing? And if you know it, you just do it.
Yep.
If you don't know it, why don't you know it? What's going on? How can you should know? Then in any situation, you should know, right? Now, this is the most important thing we are doing, right? And then when you either you finish doing that or something else becomes most important, then you drop that and do it. But, you know, that is the how the cookie crumbles, and there's no other way.
Yeah.
Well, anything else would be just like, you know, another day, another dollar dragging your feet to your retirement.
Well, you know, I think that's a really good insight for us to close on. And thank you very much for being on the show. It was a pleasure. And, you know, for our viewers, don't forget to share this video with somebody who this would be useful to. Like, subscribe, and thanks for watching. See y'all later.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Ciao.